You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, January 28th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Eric Levitz, associate editor at New York Magazine, on the upcoming civil war between Democrats over the filibuster. And then Edward Onwesso Jr. from Vice and Motherboard, the tech and labor reporter, on what's happening with the Reddit Wall Street bets. Also on the program today, Biden starts rolling back Trump's anti-abortion rules as his executive actions include opening up the ACA exchanges, using the federal buying power to push for electric cars, and halting arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Meanwhile, New York Times reports that the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, DARPA, tasked with protecting us from things like epidemics and pandemics, has been drained of resources and used as a slush fund for going on near 10 years now. Meanwhile, federal judges start to retire, opening up an opportunity for Biden's picks. And as Democrats in the Senate start talking about a less ambitious COVID relief bill, the USDA figures show that over 6 million people have been added to food stamp rolls since the beginning of the pandemic. Meanwhile, Mississippi's legislature moving to purge voters. And in Congress, a resolution introduced to expel Marjorie Taylor Greene from Congress. And lastly, while COVID deaths topped 4,000 people again yesterday, infections seem to have plateaued. The CDC still predicts we will pass 500,000 dead sometime by the end of February. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate your being here, as I appreciate Emma Viglin for being here today.
Hey, well, that's what you pay me for, so.
There you go.
You don't need to show the appreciation. That's what the money's for, in the words of Don Draper.
Well, that's what we're all talking about today with the, I know that you've made a killing on your stocks.
No.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Then. I'm holding the line. It was, again, negligible.
Ensuring you'll be here tomorrow.
Right. I won't leave after, that guy, who invested $70,000 and made $22 million on Reddit. That's the most famous.
I was not aware of that.
That was not me.
I try and avoid such information. We got a lot to cover today on the program. Let's start off with this clip from Nancy Pelosi. She was just speaking moments ago in a press conference, and there are multiple things going on, of course. We have investigations that are ongoing about the insurrection that took place 22 days ago in the Capitol building. Those investigations include trying to figure out, the reports that members of the Oath Keepers were actively trying to recruit people and gather weapons for this insurrection on the 6th. And still investigations into potential help that they may have had from members of the House or the Senate via Rudy Giuliani, et cetera, et cetera. All of this is being investigated Much of this, I imagine, will be introduced in the trial, in the impeachment, in the Senate. That will take place in about 11 days from now. I think it's the 9th of February. For the life of me, I can't remember how many days January has. I know it's somewhere between 30 and 31.
Somehow, yeah.
I forget. Like... Time has been just destroyed for me over the past year. With that said, there's also a lot of information coming out about one of the newest members of the Republican caucus in Congress. She's from Georgia. We're talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene. She was the one of the most prominent QAnon espousers, conspiracy espousers, elected to the Republican Party in the House. And Nancy Pelosi got a question about her today. We're having a little technical difficulties with playing that clip. Let's try it one more time.
I got it here.
Madam Speaker, I wanted to ask you about Marjorie Taylor Greene. How concerned are you about her past posts, remarks, rhetoric? What would you like to see done about her?
We have no sound.
Here, Brendan, let me take it.
Let's try this one more time.
COVID times, folks.
Madam Speaker, I wanted to ask you about Marjorie Taylor Greene. How concerned are you about her past posts, remarks, rhetoric? What would you like to see done about her?
What I'm concerned about is the Republican leadership in the House of Representatives, who was willing to overlook, ignore those statements, assigning her to the Education Committee when she has mocked the killing of little children at Sandy Hook Elementary School, when she has mocked the killing of teenagers in high school at the Marjory Stoneham Douglas High School. What could they be thinking, or is thinking too generous a word?
And you know, in some respects here, Pelosi is almost understating what Marjorie Taylor Greene did. On social media, she responded to a post claiming that Sandy Hook and Parkland, these two horrific shootings, one at an elementary school, one
and
at a high school.
I think the Las Vegas shooting, too. She also put out social media videos about the Las Vegas shooting. So this is a huge problem.
She responded to a post on social media that claimed that these things never happened, that they were fake. And she not just liked it, which I guess theoretically you could argue, well, I liked it just as a place marker. Then she went on to say it's all true. That's all true. She agreed with that sentiment. I mean, this is disturbing if this person just simply existed.
Which
of course they do. But the idea that she's been placed on the Education Committee by Republicans here, I guess presumably she's going to make sure that we don't have any more false flag operations there. But it really is stunning. And frankly, I've been saying this for 16 years. I wrote a book about it in 2006. The Republican Party has been barreling towards this, and there has not been even a slight touch on the brakes, right? We had a maybe 7-day period where the Republican Party showed some measure of remorse, for a tiny bit of measure of remorse by privately revealing that they may hold Donald Trump accountable for the insurrection that took place in Congress.
And now they're just not.
And now it's gone. I mean, it almost tracks perfectly with the grab them by the you-know-what tape, where people came out, Republican lawmakers were like, I can't even look my daughter in the eye and vote for this guy. And then, of course, 2 weeks go by, and then all of a sudden, I guess maybe they got a pair of glasses or something like that, and it helped them.
But, yeah, or a blindfold, so they didn't have to look their daughter in the eye.
And this is what Pelosi's doing here is exactly what the Democrats should be doing. This talk of unity, let's just for a moment take it as if at face value, that there is some belief that there are some Democratic lawmakers who believe that there is an opportunity to forge some form of unity with Republicans. Just take it at face value, as opposed to, well, we have moderate positions that we want to basically prevent the heart of the Democratic Party from passing anything that might be too progressive or too helpful to people. And we want to be able to maintain our business interests. And therefore, we join with Republicans to let them stop those things so that we don't have to own it. But let's just assume that there's a certain amount of sincerity there. That's absurd. That is completely devoid of the reality that exists in Congress and has existed in there for now almost decades.
And it's playing into Republicans' hands by pretending that's some sort of reality, because you have Ronna McDaniel, the head of the RNC, coming out, and she says QAnon is completely fringe. She said that yesterday. 30% of Republicans are sympathetic to QAnon, and those poll numbers were taken by YouGov after the Capitol insurrection. And we have a member of Congress who is a QAnon believer and didn't just do social media posts. Allegedly, it looks like her. She harassed David Hogg, one of allegedly, I don't know if it's been confirmed if that video is her, but it sure looks like her. Followed him down the street for 2 minutes, harassing him and claiming it was some sort of false flag and there were unanswered questions.
One of the Parkland survivors.
One of the Parkland survivors. That's the kind of person who's in Congress. So there is a lot of value in Pelosi saying this publicly. I would have gone further, but still, it's, as you said to me before the show, it's not Ocasio-Cortez. It's not someone who traditionally speaks out, having the leader of the Democratic Party saying something like this, it's important.
It forces the media to pay attention to it. It forces the rest of the public to pay attention to it. Because if you don't have the Democrats saying it, then nobody will say it. Because you cannot expect the media to do this on their own. They'll report on certain things, but in terms of like really hammering in just how craven the Republican Party has become from top to bottom. And I say this has been going on for decades. I still remember John Boehner being asked, I think it was by, maybe it was Lester Holt, I can't remember. Will you have your the caucus members who are bringing up legislation about the president not being an American, will you do anything about that? No, he won't. I mean, this has been ongoing, and of course it builds on itself, and gosh knows where the Republican Party is going to be 5 years from now with this stuff. So good on Nancy Pelosi. If it doesn't cause the Republicans to actually change what they do, like don't put the person who thought these shootings were false flag operations on the Education Committee, for God's sakes, then at the very least, it will force them to pay a political price on some level. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Eric Levitz about the filibuster battle that has only just begun in the Democratic Party, and particularly in the Senate caucus. We'll be right back in just a moment. Today's sponsor, BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience, if you are listening to the sound of my voice, you're getting 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majorityreport. Personally know multiple people who have used BetterHelp, and they're very happy they did. BetterHelp gives you access to their own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. If you've tried to get into therapy, and completely understandable, I mean, well, at any time, I mean, I've been in and out of therapy, I don't know if it's going to come as a huge surprise to anybody, for decades.
Hey. Look, I've tried therapy. We all gotta.
Well, and particularly now, though, and it is, people are under a tremendous amount of stress. It's getting that much harder. There's pandemic fatigue, but also very difficult to go find a therapist. Certainly have all the reason in the world not to want to go to see a therapist. Like I say, BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist through phone, chat, or video. A lot of therapists other places have long wait lists, can take weeks or months before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they can match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. And this is what happens. Once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit, for whatever reason, doesn't really matter what, at any time, you can switch for no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists. They're available from all across the country. So they may have therapists who have specialties that aren't available where you live, let's say. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/MajorityReport. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/MajorityReport. We will put the URL, it'll be clickable, in the YouTube link and, of course, in the podcast description. And lastly, this is one of those products I actually very much enjoy, and but I get a little bit bashful about talking about.
I do too.
It's the greatest love story ever told. It's the one between your butt and Hello Tushy. I did not write that. The brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment is eco-friendly, it's easy to install, and it's affordable. And all of that, frankly, is absolutely true. It is super easy to install this thing. It attaches right to your existing toilet, right underneath the toilet seat. You don't need any electricity. You don't need any additional plumbing. It cuts toilet paper use by 80%. So the Hello Tushy bidet pays for itself within a few months, and you don't worry if there's going to be some type of run on toilet paper ever again. It doesn't just cleanse your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself, and it does it before and after it's used with what they call the Smart Spray Automatic Self-Cleaning Nozzle. But it's enough to know that it cleans itself. It's super easy. Sanitation is simple. The Schmutz Shields offers easy cleaning. The knobs are naturally antimicrobial. Plus, every Hello Tushy bidet attachment comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. You can upgrade to the new 3.0 model if you're already hooked on Hello Tushy. Or if you're new to the revolution, joins millions of happy customers right now. You'll have a clean butt with every flush. Look, it was really Kyle's fault. I will just say this, because he was bragging. He's like, I got a bidet, and it's amazing. And I was like, I don't know. I mean, it just seems weird.
What is this, France?
It just seems strange.
Right.
Japan, it's huge in Japan.
Oh, Japan, yeah, too.
And then Hello Tushy was like, you know, we'd like to advertise. And I said, you know what? I always wanted to try this. And I am now, I am a believer, true believer. For the rump you love to hump. This Valentine's Day, give the gift of Hello Tushy. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners. Go to HelloTushy, TUSHY.com/majority for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority.
I love how seasonal the Hello Tushy copy is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's perfect for Valentine's Day, I guess. Also, don't forget, you can support this program by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. You get the free show, commercial-free, and you also get extra content every day. Now, I would like to welcome to the program Eric Levitz. He is the associate editor, or an associate editor, at New York Magazine. We were just saying, Eric, that... But Em and I consider you one of our favorite writers.
Yeah, I think I always tweet every time he has a new piece, like another great piece by Eric Levitz, and like someone's going to put a mosaic of all the times I do it together, because it's just every time you write something, I'm always happy to publicize it.
Yeah, no, please don't ever stop. I need my self-esteem just inflated. It's like a balloon with a little hole that needs to constantly be blown into. So
I've never met a writer like that, Eric.
Yeah.
With that said, you wrote a piece the other day. The Democrats' civil war over the filibuster has barely begun, this has been something that people have been talking about, filibuster reform, now from the days that Harry Reid was the Senate Majority Leader. Over that time, we have seen the end of the filibuster when it comes to federal judicial nominees. Then we saw it in terms of cabinet officials, and the latest was Supreme Court nominees. And now we're talking about the reform of the filibuster, legislatively speaking. Just for the sake of everybody, just lay out the land in terms of like why there has been this ongoing push, both from a generic perspective in terms of democratizing the Senate, but also from the specific perspective that we now find ourselves in, and particularly that the Democrats find themselves in the Senate.
Sure. Yeah, well, I think, you know, just generally speaking, the 2016 election really drove home to a lot more people how our political system is really dominated by these counter-majoritarian institutions, right? I mean, we saw, you know, 2000, Bush lost the popular vote, but won the presidency, but at least the popular vote was close. You know, it wasn't 2 million votes, and then suddenly we're under the rule of this demagogue, who is, you know, the most unpopular major party candidate for president ever. So I think that just that combined with then just these broader trends that popular understanding of these trends has increased in part because of concern about Trump. But basically what we're looking at right now is that the U.S. Senate, because we have so many really low population, predominantly white, predominantly rural states in the middle of our country, which itself is actually a product of the Republican Party in the 19th century, the good Republican Party, gerrymandering the Senate by adding states in that area. But what this leaves us with in the current political context is basically just a severe overrepresentation of the Republican Party in the Senate, because now we have a politics that is heavily polarized along lines of rural versus urban, college versus non-college, and white versus a more multiracial coalition, and if not polarization on race, then polarization on racial attitudes and attitudes towards, you know, do you sort of subscribe to a kind of white Christian conception of what it means to be American versus a more inclusive one, and these things overlap really pretty tightly, such that the Senate now produces a situation in which the median state, or the tipping point state in the Senate, if you do sort of abstract away and do these calculations, is 6 points, at least 6 points more Republican than the nation as a whole. Which, if you think about what that means, one way to put it is that the median voter for Senate control, the voter that that Democrats need to win, if, you know, you had all 100 seats up at once and it was a open election, that median voter is probably someone who's voted for Trump twice. So that's where we're at.
You can also just phrase it in that the 50 votes that the Republicans control in the Senate versus the 50 votes that the Democrats control in the Senate represent 41 million less actual votes cast in their favor. I mean,
that's correct.
Pretty stunning when we talk about, you know, never mind in a country of 300 million, when we talk about a country where less than half that vote in an election.
A lot of that are along racial lines as well.
Which, yeah, of course.
What the push for DC statehood, obviously.
Of course.
And angered on.
And so, all right, so that is the general argument. Talk about the specific argument in terms of like where we're at now. You speak in your piece that we could be looking at the last time that Democrats have this type of even tenuous control over our government for at least a decade.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if I'm coming through right now, but
we're here.
Okay, great. Yeah. So basically, what you have right now is that Democrats have eked out that 50 vote majority by, you know, representing 41 million more people. But also from the legacy of having, you happen to have Joe Manchin in that West Virginia seat because West Virginia used to be a Democratic state, and Manchin is just a locally popular figure who has figured out a way to hold that seat, and then also had the good fortune of being on the ballot for his most recent term in 2018, when Democrats happened to engineer, you know, with Trump's help, a national environment that was 8 points more Democratic than Republican, and that allowed Manchin to win re-election with 3% of the vote. If you have a more neutral, more regular electoral environment, as one would expect in a general election year in 2024, Manchin's performance probably, that's not going to cut it. And so what you have right now is, you know, we were able to just by the skin of our teeth eke out this majority with a seat in West Virginia that we have no business having, with John Tester in Montana, which is a similar thing. He's a very skilled politician. But we saw that basically we're in this moment where it's very hard to mint new Testers and new Manchins. And one theory for why this is the case, you know, which we saw, by the way, this past year with Steve Bullock, popular governor of Montana. If anyone's going to be able to win there, you would think he would. It's not just that he didn't win. It's that he lost by more than 10 points. So we didn't come close. And the one theory for why this is all happening is that Democrats have always had a disadvantage because of the Senate, basically, because, you know, the divide between city and countryside is one of the oldest political divides in, like, human civilization. It tends to have a conflict in the cultural values and economic interests, not always, but often. And Democrats, because they were the party of the urban machines, the trade unions, which were located in dense areas, they've always been the party primarily associated with cities. This has always been a disadvantage for them, but when you still had a solid South that was Democratic and aligned with Northern liberals for a brief period during the New Deal, you could solve that problem. Post the Civil Rights Act, Democrats still were able to make things work by really localizing Senate races, finding good candidates with strong connections. And this worked in an environment where people got most of their political information from local journalism. In an environment where broadband internet, there's actually a study that shows that you show areas that got an expansion of rural broadband and those that didn't. And those that did, ticket splitting plummets. So when people have access to the internet, they gravitate towards nationally oriented, ideologically motivated media, and they suddenly become more ideological voters. They vote straight down ticket. They don't care that, you know, the Democrats recruited a really charismatic guy who coaches Little League or whatever. They're voting on, you know, stopping creeping socialism or whatever. And so this has produced a situation where the outlook looks pretty grim for keeping the Senate in 2024, if not in 2022. The 2022 map is kind of favorable to us, but there's still going to be headwinds in being the in-party power. But the problem is that because the ultimate issue here is that the state lines are what's producing the Senate problem, that also means that Republicans control more state legislatures and governor's mansions than we do, which means that the House map is going to be gerrymandered towards Republicans because there's more places where they get to do full-scale gerrymandering with no minority input than there is places where Democrats have the power to do that. So you're going to have a gerrymandered House map. You're going to have this really difficult Senate situation. And then slightly relatedly, slightly separately, the decline of, trade unions in the Midwest is creating this electoral college problem where Joe Biden basically had to win the popular vote, the two-way popular vote by 4 points to have a 50% chance of beating Trump this past November. He just barely got by that. If Biden won the popular vote by like 3.7%, Trump would have won re-election. So you're looking at a situation where by 2024, things could be very bad if Democrats do not give themselves the power to legislate a structural change.
All right. Eric's internet cut out for a moment. I'm sorry, you cut out for 1 second. But I guess the bottom line is that the Democrats have the bottom line is the Democrats have this one opportunity to impact structural change that could help them in terms of election, whether that's voting changes in voting rights, expanding in voting rights or whatnot. But it's also their last opportunity. There's an urgency here for them to get legislation passed and supposedly fulfill the mandate, if you want to call it that, or at least the agenda that the that is associated with the Democratic Party. And we have a situation where we now have two senators, Manchin and Sinema, who have come out and vowed we will not bust. And this is important. The verb is really important in this. We will not bust the filibuster. Now, assess that vow for us based upon two things. One, that they were also supportive of Chuck Schumer not going forward with Mitch McConnell's demand that they take busting the filibuster off the table for the organizing resolution at the beginning of the Senate. That and the concept of like, okay, reforming the filibuster is not the same as busting the filibuster. Reforming the filibuster is not the same as getting rid of the filibuster. Address those two things.
Yeah. So, and I'm not saying that we should, you know, have faith that Sinema and Manchin are playing a game and are not just, you know, kind of really awful senators or for, you know, Democrats, at least Sinema. Sinema has no business. She doesn't have an excuse. Arizona is turning blue. But I think that there is significance in the two things that you pointed to. Right. So for one thing, as you suggested, there was this fight over the organizing resolution. McConnell was holding the Senate hostage to try to get this formal written pledge to that we were not going to abolish the filibuster this session. Manchin expressed support for Schumer's position that we're going to keep this out so that we have leverage in negotiations. Well, it doesn't really make much sense to view that as leverage if you truly 100% are not going to touch the filibuster, then you have no leverage. The other aspect is, again, like you alluded to, I think that there's a lot that you can do and that we've seen that you can do to the filibuster without straightforwardly abolishing it. I mean, that's why we have this whole insane budget reconciliation process, right? That the Senate, you know, the Congress gave themselves the permission to pass things by a simple majority in the Senate if they follow these specific rules. So one could imagine it creating a new exemption such that all bills that expand voting rights or expand democratic democracy reforms are not subject to a filibuster. You can't filibuster that because we all remember that the filibuster was used against civil rights legislation. So it's really important to establish this principle that voting rights legislation, you can't filibuster that. You could imagine them, you know, restoring a talking filibuster, which would effectively make it, you know, impossible. Republicans would need to sustain and hold the Senate floor continuously. There are things that you could do, and you could frame that as a restoration of Senate tradition, not a violation of it. So there are things that you could do if Manchin and Sinema are willing to play ball, but they have this thing of, we want to be able to say we didn't abolish the filibuster. There's room for maneuver there if they are actually team players, but we're not sure of that.
And the filibuster rules are that malleable? I mean, basically, you can create a reality and a set of rules outside of, you know, procedure to allow for something like that. I mean, I would imagine that there might be some pushback in terms of just saying, oh, you know, we carved out judicial appointments and the Supreme Court picks from the filibuster, like that's actually possible.
Yeah, so there's a couple constitutional constraints on what the Senate can do in terms of, like, Kamala Harris can't provide quorum for a Senate session, which creates some opportunities for McConnell to really create chaos. Although I think there's ways around it, but beyond that, the Senate is sovereign over its own rules, and specifically Senate majorities are sovereign. So although there's, like, you know, existing rules, my understanding is a Senate majority can change the rules to anything that's not barred by the Constitution. So, yeah, I believe that they can.
So, Eric, so let me ask you this. I understand what you're saying when you refer to the potential of Sinema and Manchin just being bad senators. But let's get a little bit more explicit as to the why would they not? I mean, is it just this notion of like institutional fealty? Because I would imagine that there is. It's very hard to make the argument that there's anybody who's not more of an institutionalist when it comes to the Senate than Joe Biden, right? I mean, and so if Joe Biden comes down to the and calls up Manchin or Sinema and says, "Hey guys, there's a couple of things that we need to get done here," but what would be their, you know, what are their interests that would be promoted by not in any way reforming the filibuster? I mean, I can understand why you would say, I'm not going to bust the filibuster, but I will reform it, because you want to promote this veneer of a brand that you have that is like, I am not some type of, you know, radical flamethrower type of thing. And you want to maintain that brand, even if your constituents don't particularly care about how you vote for procedural. It just creates a brand that you apply to other areas. But what would be in their interest to not reform it? Is it just an extension of that theory or what?
Yeah, I think it's partly that. I think it depends how much you're reforming it. So I think that one could see Manchin having an interest in immigration reform never getting a vote because, oh, we don't have 10 Republicans, so I never have to take a vote on that. I never have to reveal to my really kind of weird coalition of actual Democrats in West Virginia and right-leaning independents that I actually have a specific position on that issue that's going to piss off half of them. Or, you know, a gun control bill or whatever. This is a shield against Democratic accountability, and that's useful to some senators. But so if it's a tailored, you know, filibuster revision, then I see that being less compelling. But I do think that's part of what motivates just general sort of across the caucus, is there's a lot of issues that cross pressure senators from their donors and voters from different voting blocks in their states. And it's very handy for them. I think one reason McConnell didn't abolish the filibuster himself is Republicans also really like not having to confront every issue where they assure their base they're for it and assure their donors they're not for it. So that's one function that the filibuster serves for senators. I'm not sure if that's the primary one here or not.
That's fascinating. And if you're correct in that speculation, then it's more likely we will see a tailored reconciliation style type of reform to the filibuster than a procedural reform to the filibuster, which makes it harder to implement, right? There'll be issues of voting as opposed to immigration, or issues of healthcare as opposed to gun control, versus, you know, the senator needs to be on the floor for 24 hours, and then it knocks it down to 55 votes that you need, or something like that.
Yeah, I think, this is all speculation. And I think that the big question is, you know, ultimately, I think what you need as a precondition for reforming the filibuster is a specific piece of legislation that is popular, that has real strong support within the coalition. And you need absolute Republican obstruction of that. And then to have an opportunity for Manchin and Sinema to say, oh, more in sorrow than in anger, you know, McConnell has driven us to this place where, what a sad day for the institution, but I have no choice but to whatever.
Do you have a sense of what that bill would be if there are people in the Democratic caucus who have been, you know, we've got the bill, we've got it on the shelf, we're going to deploy it in March, or we're going to deploy it in April? Has the planning gone that far? And if so, do you have a sense of what the timing and what the bill might be?
So I don't. I think that, you know, there are things that are more popular maybe on the Democratic agenda, like, you know, the $15 minimum wage if it gets rejected in reconciliation. But I think in reference to the stuff that we began with, you know, the real push among Indivisible, among a lot of people in the party who actually care about the party's future as an institution, is the voting rights and democracy reform.
We've lost Eric again. Well, I think that's it. And in terms of the timing, I guess we will find out. Eric Levitz, folks, we will put a link to Eric's piece, The Democrats' Civil War Over the Filibuster Has Barely Begun. And now, if we have Edward?
We do.
Okay. I'd like to welcome to the program Edward Ongweso, Jr. He is the tech and labor reporter at Vice Motherboard. Edward, are you there?
It looks like he's still connecting here, so maybe do you want me to play a short break while he connects?
Yeah, let's take a short break. We'll get him connected, and then we will go forward.
All right, here it is.
Edward Ongweso, he is the junior tech and labor reporter at Vice Motherboard. Eric, welcome to the Edward, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So, Happy New Year. So, Edward, will you just walk us through? I mean, I think you know, people educated themselves on shorting stocks and Reddit more in the past 24 hours than perhaps people have done in a lifetime. But walk us through this as if I was A, too old to understand Reddit, and B, too financially illiterate to understand shorting.
Which certainly isn't the reality.
No, it's absolutely not in any fashion whatsoever.
So I think this begins with, you know, GameStop being in of itself a company that for years has struggled to make profits. And it was last year they began to make some changes, adding members to the board, announcing strong, you know, growth in e-commerce sales that made people think a turnaround was in the cards.
And Ed, would you say that GameStop is a retail place?
Yes. Yeah, it's a game retailer.
And you would buy video games, and you know, and some kids would just hang out in there for hours and play.
Right. It's a lot of brick and mortar locations. So part of the excitement was closing down stores and shifting more to e-commerce. And it brought on a board member who is associated with, or who was the former CEO of Chewy, which is this like, you know, pet food online retailer. So, you know, there is a crowd of people online on Reddit in this subcommunity called Wall Street Bets. They're basically like, you know, day traders or small time traders who invest and throw money into stocks that believe that there was value in this. And some of them took long positions. Some of them began to invest in it. At the same time, short sellers had been over time getting a little bit more greedy and a little bit more they were anticipating a drop in the price, right? They were saying that it wasn't worth the price that it was trading at, or that would be worth less. And so they're taking up positions over time to short the stock, basically to, in anticipation of it going lower, right? Borrow shares, sell them, buy them back at a lower price, and then return those ones and pocket the difference. So they began to short eventually until there was more of these shorts sales going on than there were actual stocks of GameStop. People in this community noticed.
Wait a second. I got to stop you there.
Yeah.
I get the concept of, all right, I'm convinced the stock is selling for $5 now. Today, January 28th, I'm going to make a contract with, you know, unnamed people that on February 28th, I'm going to deliver the stock to you at $4. And that's the deal I make. And so I'm betting that the stock is actually going to drop down to $3. And I'm going to make that extra buck by selling it to these people who have agreed to buy it to me from $4. How do you control more stocks to deliver a month from now, let's say, whatever the term is, than exist? Like, how do you fulfill that? I don't understand that concept.
Yeah, that's part of the problem that emerges. You know, part of it is that you can technically borrow shares. So I can go to someone's broker and I can borrow shares that they've, you know, given to someone to hold themselves, if they haven't already said, like, don't let my, you know, shares get offered up to anyone who needs them to, for a short sale, that needs them to be lended. There are also, you know, companies that offer, you know, lending programs, where you can give up an asset and someone else can, give you collateral equal to the market price. And, you know, they can hold it sometimes for the short sales as well. But it really just comes down to, this is a thing that happens sometimes, but it's not usually noticed and seized upon, and there's never some sort of like attack, you know, in response to it. It's usually a hedge fund might do it, but they'll also cover their asses a bit with other positions, or, you know, covering the contract itself with more stock, you know, figuring out ways to hedge the bet. And, you know, the hedge funds that were up against the Reddit community, Citron Research, you know, Melvin Capital, two of the bigger ones, were famously uncovered, you know, in these positions. And Citron in particular, you know, tried to taunt, I guess, or goad the investors by saying they didn't know what they were talking about, that in reality, they knew what the real value was.
So, okay. So, Citron and Melvin make a bet that the stock is going down lower and they're willing to deliver the stock, let's say a month out. Actually, I think it's going to be tomorrow.
It's tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're going to deliver it to you at a certain price. We're actually convinced it's going to be lower by then. So we're going to make some money off of that. How do people on Reddit or people anywhere, how do they become aware that Melvin and Citron, own all of these, or have shorted the stock in this way? Is Melvin going out there and Citron going out there bragging that they have? I mean, as a way of essentially driving down the value of the stock, right? Or no? I mean, why else would you tell people?
That's part of the thing. Like, there is a practice or a ritual where, you know, you do all this research or you put out a report where you're like, oh, I did all this research. This is why the stock isn't actually worth this and it's worth less. And that is supposed to act as a catalyst and drop the price down to a level where you can then profit off of. And the community, from what I can see, found out through just like, you know, digging, essentially, you know, a lot of places put their positions online also. A lot of stocks there was someone who was insisting that it had value and why they thought it was going to grow and why they took this long position. And it was partly through this person guiding people through that they realized that there were more shares being shorted than shares existed. And that led to, you know, a domino effect where eventually they realized it was Citron and Melvin began buying the shares to increase the price, which then forced these hedge funds to buy more shares to cover their contract, because if they didn't, they would have had, you know, they would have lost the whole thing and they would have, you know, been left holding the bag. And then it just became a squeeze, essentially, where the price gets pushed up and they're still trying to hold on their short and they're not going to close out the position because they want the money. So they keep trying to convince people, you know, to drop the stock, to sell it, and they weren't able to. And the stock began to skyrocket about a week ago, right? Or, you know, a week to 2 weeks ago.
So this is fascinating. So what happens is the people get wind of the fact that Citron and Melvin are exposed.
Right.
Start pushing up the stock. Citron and Melvin start to panic a little bit because they're like, we're supposed to deliver this stock at half the price it's at now, and it seems to be going up. So we're going to buy some, which then pushes the stock up more because everybody else continues to do that. So this is sort of like the weird thing about this is that it seems like similar to a pump and dump on some level, at least from the perspective of the Reddit buyers, that they all buy it to get other people to buy it, to push it up. But it seems like a lot of the Reddit people are not doing the dump part, which suggests that their motivation isn't totally about making a huge killing off this, that there's another agenda going on. Explain that.
Yeah, I think there's like a few moving parts here. One, there are some who want to make the money, but realize that they have to hold past a certain point to really make the money. And then there are others who are just like angry, I would say, or, you know, justified rage at, you know, the fact that short sellers and other financial, you know, players are allowed to do this sort of thing and they're hailed for it or they're praised for it. But when a community of day traders essentially does it, then it results in a huge amount of backlash and complaining and crying on the business press channels about how this is, you know, the end of capitalism or the end of free markets. And I think that, you know, when you go through the subreddit, you also see a lot of posts from people expressing that, you know, they lost money on previous, you know, panics or, you know, market downturns, or they're angry at the fact that, you know, traders are allowed to get away with so much, or they don't have much money themselves. And so a loss for them is not as big as a loss will be for a hedge fund. You know, like they'll put $600 into a few stocks of GameStop, but it will help contribute to this moment where they're going to, you know, basically take billions away from these funds. So it is a bunch of things moving together. But definitely, I think a core catalyst is like people with not too much to lose, pretty furious at like largesse and greed coming from these few firms.
Well, it is a form of activism, I think, even though, yes, there are going to be some big firms like BlackRock that benefit substantially from this. But I wanted to talk about that double standard a little bit based on the updates today that Robinhood and other organizations have halted trading. It seems like they're not halting selling, which allows the stock to go down, the price to be driven down of what all of these Redditors were buying, like GameStop, AMC, Nokia, other stock like that. And so that seems to be, I mean, I know Rashida Tlaib and Ocasio-Cortez have now tweeted about this, and Ted Cruz saying that this needs to be investigated. That seems to be much more substantial market manipulation than some Redditors taking down hedge funds in a targeted way. This has ripple effects with the market, especially over the next few days.
Yeah, you know, I think it's pretty blatant manipulation, you know, at this point, to halt the trade so that only sales can happen. It'll drop the price low enough where a lot of these funds or short sellers might be able to cover their position at a better price and not take so huge of a loss. And also, you know, it's kind of like a last minute attempt, I feel, to stop this. You know, on Friday, a lot of the shares that they borrowed were going to come due and would have likely knocked out more hedge funds, right? And so to do this at the very last minute might free up or scare people enough to sell enough to cover those shorts and save them from, you know, eating their lunch on this. But it is, I think, at the end of the day, like pretty obviously blatant, you know, hypocrisy, right? People get incredibly mad when individuals do this sort of speculation, but companies do it all the time, and that's their business model, right? Hedge funds do this. That's their business model. Private equity is allowed to do it. You know, investment firms, asset managers are allowed to do it. Nobody blinks an eye, you know?
Shorting a stock to a point where you have so many of these shorts that people are discouraged from even investing in a company like GameStop, right? Mm-hmm. How is that not market manipulation in and of itself? Because they are basically making that stock, that company, so toxic because they're shorting it at such an inordinate rate.
You know, yeah, you know, at the end of the day, it's like really clear in my eyes. You know, there are some people who will defend short selling as, you know, part of efficient market or whatever, but at the end of the day, this is just like another technique or another tool that is used by traders and by large firms to move capital, you know, as fast as possible into their own pockets, right? And, you know, we can dress it up as they do in a lot of fancy, you know, logic or rationale about how it helps the market stay, you know, functional, but what it's okay when they do it, but when other people do it, and not even as an organized fashion, right? With not even as much capital behind them, targeting maybe one or two firms. That's, you know, that's the end of the world. And that sadly might result in more regulation than the fact that these firms have been doing that for years and years and years.
That is what is astonishing. You have a bunch of people, certainly, like you have outlined, there's a bunch of motivations as to why they did this, right? Including, I want to make some profit. I see a weakness in their position. And other people who are now, and it seems like it's garnered even more energy, this idea of like, actually, this is really more about screwing this big player, these big players, and essentially saying to the market, despite the fact that you have all the capital and you have all the power, we have figured out a vulnerability here. If you are motivated by the fact that you feel like the system has been rigged and you're exploiting a weakness, and then the system comes in and says, actually, now we're, the referees step in and go like, hey, we're only going to let the team that has players over 7 feet. We've just changed it. There's no more field goals. There's only you have to touch the rim for the points to count. I mean, that's stunning. And what happens? All right, it's all well and good that they can shut this down this time. I mean, I would imagine there's going to be even more sort of people power in these Reddits who are going, we're going to find the next one. We're going to do this again. And then we're going to do it again. And we're going to do it again. I mean, they can't keep shutting down purchasing or selling depending on what the big players need. This is not sustainable now, is it?
Yeah, in all honesty, let them do it. I'm not going to shed any tears if another few hedge funds collapse. If they're being, especially the ones that are, greedily trying to short more than the shares in the company, actually has. And in all honesty, this is the backlash that they're going to deserve. GameStop is a bit unique because of a bunch of like perfect storm of events and people who amplified it or were able to get others to trade onto it, but to so blatantly try to kill it so that you can protect essentially, protect the bottom lines of a few hedge funds that were caught, fucking up essentially. There's really no defense for it. And I think that it is going to get worse in all likelihood. I can't see that community or all the other people involved in this just simply going, well, I guess we just got to not do it again because TD American or Schwab or Robinhood decided that we can't do it. That's only going to add more fuel to the fire.
Well, this is like a great issue for somebody to champion and have hearings on the fact that, A, maybe it's a bad idea to be shorting more stocks than are actually physically available for a company. And it's also, if you're going to function as a broker, the idea that you're going to all of a sudden like curtail services on any given moment to help a certain buyer or seller seems illegal.
How are you going to make money? How are you going to make money if you can't do any of that?
Good point. I forgot about that.
All right. Yeah. Well, Edward Onwesso, Jr., thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And we will link to your writings over at Tech and Labor over Advice Motherboard. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks.
All right. We got to take no, I guess we're not taking a break. I mean, this is
I love this story.
It is it's an amazing story. I mean, I don't know if I would call it activism because I don't think that there is any type of sort of structural change that these people are pushing for. But I do think it's like, it's just revenge. It's just revenge. And it is definitely, they are not motivated. I would imagine many of them are motivated by making, money, and they certainly were originally, but I think the added motivation there is some seeking of some form of justice. Maybe it is activism. I don't know.
I mean, does activism have to necessarily have one specific goal in mind? I mean, you could argue that this is like an extension of what Occupy was, which was, I mean, I know it's not because it's often.
Well, there's no structural reform I think these people are going after. I think it is more they want to just punish these hedge funders, although.
But punishing them for shorting more stock than is available for a company, I think that. Like the punishing is a tacit admission that they want some sort of structural change.
Maybe they'll get it. At the very least, it seems to me that if you're going to name your company Robinhood and you deploy you change your the ability for people to purchased this stock for the benefit of massively wealthy hedge funders and their funders.
And Robinhood has this reputation in New York. I mean, they just did that massive COVID benefit with Tina Fey, like earlier in the year. They try to portray themselves as equitable and kind Wall Street. This might take a hit. reputation might take a hit right now.
It would be very interesting if the phone company came in and said, "We're not going to allow outgoing calls from Robinhood's offices. You just got to hope that a crisis manager calls into you and offers their services." That's it for us today. We will be back tomorrow with more for Emma and myself. See you then. And again, of course, if you missed any part of this show, you can see it replay at 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. on the Peacock app, the Choice channel. Meanwhile, we will be heading into the fun half momentarily, wherein the entire crew will guide the ship to its landing, as it were.
That's where a lot are we landing?
I was going to say, there's a lot of mixed metaphors there that I didn't quite work out before.
Yeah, guiding the ship.
Guiding the ship of the fun half in the across the stormy fun seas. Folks, just a reminder, this program...
Easy there, Melville.
Yeah, how do you feel, Matt, as the literary hangover podcast host? What do you think about that?
Not quite Joseph Conrad there.
Do I get an F for Friedman on that on those mixed metaphors? You can support this show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show, free of commercials. You support the free show, and then we give you extra content virtually every day. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget amquickie.com. Get 7 minutes headlines every morning delivered to your podcast service. Or you can sign up at amquickie.com, or you can just search, I don't know, Stitcher or iTunes or Pocket Casts or podcastapp.com, whatever it is.
Really loose today.
Yeah, I know.
Jeez.
And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Don't forget, tune in to Nomi's show today. You can find it on Twitch or YouTube, the Nomi Key Show. And on that program today, John Nichols. Oh, wow. From The Nation Magazine. He's great. Longtime guy I've been interviewing for years. He's terrific. He's out of Wisconsin. Representative Chris Robb and Arun Chaudhry will be joining Nomiki 3 p.m. on YouTube and Twitch. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we had on Jared Shanahan and Zana Kurti from the Hard Crackers Journal to inaugurate our new era of unrest. We talked about the origins of the journal in the work of Noel Ignatieff on whiteness and the abolition thereof, race treason in the George Floyd uprising, and finally, the January 6th Capitol siege and how the left can take insurrectionism back from the Trumpist pretenders. That's out now. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. We got a bonus coming out on Friday. That's tomorrow as well with more of our awesome guests. Also, we had a really good Twitch stream last night, twitch.tv/TheAntifada. My friend Kay Gabriel from my caucus, Emerge in DSA, kind of gave a defense of the defund the police campaigns because, believe it or not, we've had on some guests lately who were critical of it from an ultra-left perspective, so I thought it was important to bring someone on who has a different perspective and is also a communist, and that's still up. We're going to put that out in podcast form, probably. And then tonight, oh my God, it's tonight, I myself will be moderating a teach-in presented by Emerge, DSA Emerge, my caucus. And that is with Assad Haider, editor of Viewpoint Magazine. And it's about communist politics in our time. So you could check that out. Oh, God, I'll put a link in the episode description because there's not a tidy URL that I can say.
Check out the podcast description for that full slate on the Antifada. And old Matt, first off, old Matt Binder.
Hello, Sam.
host of Doomed. Matt put out a video last night. Was it last night? Time is really.
It was like the afternoon I put it out, but it was yesterday. Yes,
a great video on the Boogaloo Boys, because there's been, I'm not sure if people are aware, for those of you who are not on Twitter 24/7, there has been some controversy about the Boogaloo Boys, and very important for you to understand who they are.
I saw that, Matt. Really good job.
Whether you're a host of a talk show that's platforming them or not, it's important to know who they are.
Or an enabler of
imagine if you were doing this professionally, you'd have a notion of who they were, or you'd be interested in who they are. So send this to whoever you think might need to know who the Boogaloo Boys are. But honestly, Matt, it was really well done. It was very, I thought it was very fair. You weren't picking on anybody in any way, because some people get their, they are sensitive to these things. I don't really
care to go after Jimmy. That's not the point. The point is that there are people who heard him talk to that Boogaloo Boy, and that Boogaloo Boy succeeded in reaching out to those Jimmy Dore followers and listeners and viewers, whatever Jimmy Dore calls his fans, those Dorites. And, and I see them online talking about maybe we should work with these guys. Maybe we should reach out to more white supremacists and right wingers and see what's where there's, you know, ground we can agree on. I mean, yeah, there's some basic stuff everyone agrees on. I mean, we all need to eat, don't we? But I mean, that doesn't mean that you unite with them or give them a platform publicly to just espouse whatever they want without providing any real pushback or criticism.
Yeah, I thought that was really well done. And you made that point that, like, it's one thing to reach out to individuals as, you know, Bill, Tom, Mary, or Betty as individuals. But it's another to reach out to organizations or people who are there representing or, you know, unofficially or officially representing organizations. That's the whole point. Right. As individuals, yes, we should reach out to everybody. I am all in favor of people going and, you know, trying to convert or build relationships or organize with individuals who may, you know, hold ideas that I disagree with, because that's the way that you get those people maybe to not hold those ideas. But when you platform an organization, then what you're doing is validating the organization and their principles. So what's happening on Doom besides that amazing video that you made that people can find, I would imagine, where?
All right, go to youtube.com/Matt Binder to catch that video. It's not, you know, it's a video, so it's not going to come out as the podcast version of the show. It's about 15 minutes long. I want to push that this week. Go to youtube.com/Matt Binder for that video. Also, if you'd like to support me doing future stuff like that, I would love to do more videos like that. Patreon.com/Matt Binder to, you know, toss me some money to motivate me to do more of those.
And new Matt, what is happening in your media empire?
Yeah, tonight 8 Eastern at the Left Reckoning YouTube channel, we're doing a live show. We have Jennifer Pan of the Jacobin Show. We're going to be talking about leaving the culture war behind, and also some of this topical Biden and GameStop stuff. So that's tonight at 8, the new time for Left Reckoning, youtube.com/Left Reckoning.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number, and these guys will see you in the fun half, and I will see you on Friday. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27, 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.